You're listening to All Things Trek with DJ Bob and DJ Warren. Music breaks have been cut out due to copyright reasons. If you'd like to hear the music, please tune in live Saturdays from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Pacific. That's 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern on riserradio.com.
So, take two, welcome to All Things Trek at riserradio.com.
You guys were fortunate enough not to hear the result of my fifth heart attack today. This has been pretty spectacular.
The palpitations were so loud, it was like I was listening to some kid with his 20-inch subwoofer. It was amazing.
It was. I was shaking the building. Anyway.
technical glitch aside, we are now here broadcasting. My broadcast software says we are broadcasting, so, ha.
Hopefully you can hear all of us.
That's right.
Anyway, I'm DJ Oren.
I'm DJ Bob. And you're listening to All Things Trek here. So there's a couple ways you can interact with us, as I'm sure many of you know, and if you guys have been listening. Those who haven't listened before, here's how. There's a couple ways. One, log into Star Trek Online and go to the RR channel, which stands for Riser Radio. You could be there. I'm in there, in our chat right now. So if you're like, hey, Bob, I've got this thing I want to say, or, oh my gosh, I hate Oren so much, or I want to call him out and things, which seems to frequently happen every so often in the show now.
Let's not invite the flood, Bob.
I'm just saying, this is a thing that happens now.
Yeah, all right.
Is what it is.
We'll see.
You can also email us at allthingstrek@hotmail.com, and you can also go to our forums, which is found through riserradio.com. Just go to the community tab, go down to 10 forward. We've got our own section, All Things Trek.
10 forward. That feels like some kind of reference to something. I'm not sure. Is that a reference to something Star Trek related, Bob?
Nah, too obscure.
Okay, cool.
Too obscure. So we got a guest with us today.
We do. We will be doing our first interview, which I think is nice because it's our fifth episode. Any number that ends with 5 and 0 is by definition some kind of landmark. So we have...
Like Star Trek 5.
Yeah. Ooh, Star Trek 5. Ooh, you just did that. You went there, Bob. I wasn't going to. All right, so today we are going to be interviewing Kathy Ferguson.
Say hi, Kathy, to all listeners.
Hi, everybody.
She teaches political science and women's studies at the University of Hawaii. She has just recently published a book on Emma Goldman called Political Thinking in the Streets. And she just I'm going to repeat that because it may not have been loud enough. She teaches political science and women's studies at the University of Hawaii, and she just published a book on Emma Goldman called Political Thinking in the Streets. And she also teaches political theory in Star Trek. And you heard that right. She teaches the political theory class on Star Trek.
I'm not sure I'm comfortable with you around, Kathy. Your credentials are a lot cooler than mine.
It's true. And she's also been a fan of the original series since its first set of reruns.
When was it first being rerun, anyway?
Right after the first 3 years it was made, they started rerunning it.
So right there in 68, 69,
yeah,
they started.
Exactly.
Right on.
Oh, and in the nature of in the interest of transparency, she also has the mark of being my mother, which is which is how I was able to get someone with such a long list of credentials on our show. I pulled family influence on this one.
It's true, he did.
So Kathy, what was your first experience with Star Trek? Tell us about that.
Well, I actually didn't watch it during its first 3 years of production. I was in high school. I wasn't interested. Now I watched things like Big Valley, cowboy shows. And then I went to college, and Star Trek had become huge by then. It was already a cult phenomenon on college campuses.
Right.
And we had, this will date me, in 1968... No one had a TV in their rooms. There was one television in a dorm for 1,600 people. And that one television was in a place called the TV room.
Ooh, and get fancy with that one right
the
there.
The TV room probably held 60 people comfortably and would have 100 people packed in every night that they showed the Star Trek reruns. So that's how I started watching, was just following the herd as it went to the TV room to watch the Star Trek reruns.
Well, that's pretty cool.
And so you weren't really into other science fiction before Star Trek?
No, I don't think I'd ever even heard of science fiction or knew that it existed as a genre.
So this was just something that you heard like some of your friends talking about?
Yep.
And you heard and you decided to check it out?
Exactly.
Well, how did it compare to like other television shows that were on at the time?
Well, I think what I really liked about it was the camaraderie of the people. The way that
The fans or the people on the show?
The camaraderie, the characters.
Mm-hmm.
How they work together to solve problems, how they were they had friendships that were not limited by the race or the sex of the person. So the Uhura was a really strong member of the team, and so, they had a Russian, which was pretty radical during the Cold War.
We put some quotation marks around Russian here. Nuclear weapons.
He was supposed to be a Russian. So I just liked how they assembled a group of people who were different in their background and their gender and their race, and that they cooperated, they solved problems together, they were part of a whole that was very rewarding. And they had a lot of adventures. I love the adventure.
Mm-hmm. So you like that you like that moment at the end of a lot of the episodes where, like, you know, they've just had this adventure, and then Kirk and Spock and McCoy are hanging out on the bridge, and, like, usually one of them will give each other a hard time.
Yep, the yucking it up on the bridge moment. I think of that as a classic Roddenberry touch. He really liked that little twist at the end where friendships are reaffirmed through joking.
Yeah, I liked that. That was one of the things that made me sad when Roddenberry stopped being part of the show, was that they did that for a little bit in Early Next Generation. Even though I didn't really care for Early Next Generation, I did like those moments, and then they stopped when Roddenberry wasn't part of the show anymore. So, and was this something, like, was Star Trek something that you liked immediately, or did it take a while to grow on?
No, I liked it right away. I have to say that the less intellectual reason was I thought Kirk was really sexy.
Well, so you're hardly alone there.
And I was 18, so I, that was kind of on my mind.
Although apparently,
I'm 24 and male. I think Kirk is sexy. At least then he was. I don't know about now. But
although apparently Spock actually tested much better with female viewers than Kirk did, just statistically speaking. But I can't fault you for either of those. Now, and do you, like, nowadays when we look at the original series, the special effects tend to look really cheesy, and, it's like, oh, look, they beamed onto another planet full of cardboard rocks.
But those were the best kind of special effects. I appreciate those effects now, today.
So I was just wondering, how did the special effects compare to, like, other shows? And did other shows even have special effects?
No, because there weren't any special effects anywhere that I can think of. I mean, if you think about the Westerns, they... those were kind of cardboard horses too, right? So, I think it was just so unsophisticated that it didn't occur to us to think about it that way. Now, when you look back at it, and you can almost see the string holding the ship that some guy is dangling across the screen.
You can in some episodes. Yeah. Then my favorite is the episode where they go back in time, go back in time. They go down on a shuttlecraft, and you can actually see the guy's hand as he opens and closes the shuttlecraft doors.
Oh man, I have to see some of those.
But, yeah. I apologize. I feel like I cut you off there.
But just we didn't have any expectations for special effects. They were just the background to a good story. What really mattered was a good story.
Michael Bay would disagree with you.
Yeah, man, I wish we had.
He's
that
guy who did Transformers and what, like, the new stuff where it's like explosions everywhere. And is there an explosion happening? If there's not an explosion happening, why isn't there one now? Yeah. This is how we tell explosions. I tell stories with explosions.
I'd like to tell stories with words and people and.
Yeah, I mean,
things like that.
In theory,
that's the 20th century, though.
Your special effects should be used to tell a story rather than your story being an excuse to show off some special effects. Did you, and do you remember what the first episode you saw was?
I don't actually remember the first episode. I just remember seeing it in that TV room in the dorm and being intrigued by it. And I can't tell you which one it was.
Do you remember, do you remember what phase of the show it was in? Like, did, let's think, what are some hallmarks of the show as it moved forward? Like, did they have Chekhov yet?
Oh, yeah.
So definitely. Chekhov was there when you started watching.
In fact, I never knew that there wasn't a Chekhov. For years, I didn't realize he came on later. The crew was in place, and so it had to have been one of the later episodes, it had to be into the series a little bit.
So, yeah. Then did you, there's kind of an interesting shift from season 2 to season 3. Because, season 2 was when it got canceled, and then it was renewed for another third season because of a huge fan letter-writing campaign. And, season 3 has a kind of a very distinct feel to it. Because, season 3 tends to have a lot of extremes. Like, some of the really, really goofy episodes are in season 3. But season 3 also has some really good episodes. Did you notice?
Roddenberry wasn't involved so much in season 3, was he?
Yeah, he wasn't quite as involved. Although he was still fairly involved. He still wrote the last episode, and he was still there, but he wasn't... as strongly involved in it, because by that point he was working on other shows. I think that's how it went. Do you remember seeing that when it happened?
No, I don't. I was not a very sophisticated viewer of the original Star Trek. I think maybe one of the reasons that I don't use that many of the early Star Treks in my class is that the things that I look for that class are more present in the later with a few exceptions, which I can tell you about later, are more present in the later series.
Mm-hmm. Just due to like contemporary relevance, or
more, it seems, in terms of the writing, the themes. To be useful to my class, there has to be a perceptible political theme about justice or courage or revolution or something like that.
What about Omega Glory, where the message is that the spirit of America will live on
an alien world?
Yeah, well, that was, to me, even at that
discovering new civilizations that are sort of the same.
Yeah, was a disappointment, because one of the things that I have come to expect from science fiction is that it takes the familiar and makes it strange. That's why it's such a great genre for thinking about politics, because you take something that people are used to, but then you twist it in a way so it's totally not the same. Or you do it in the reverse. You take something totally weird and odd, and you make it similar. So that playing, Freud called that the uncanny. The uncanny is that moment where the similar and the strange are right up against
each other. She name-dropped Freud. I feel already very uneducated.
Man, the intellectual level of this podcast is going up by a substantial amount. I don't even know if this is really qualifies as a podcast. So what was your favorite episode of the original series? I wanted to know this for a while.
Well, my favorite episode was one where the uncanny was at work, where the one you just mentioned, Omega Glory. Totally missed that opportunity, because it was the familiar in the familiar. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was nothing strange, right? They took the Cold War and they plopped it into some other planet, and then, of course, America was the hero and the communists were the villains.
Although we did have a bunch of Chinese people with samurai swords. And, well, that was a little strange.
They didn't... In political theory terms, we use the word queer to talk about this making something strange. They didn't queer it. It was totally straight. Mm-hmm. You know, it was take the familiar, plop it down in a new place, it's still familiar. Whereas I loved the episode about the people who are black on one side and white on the other.
Let That Be Your Last Battlefield.
Let That Be Your Last Battlefield.
That is a really good episode.
I thought that was a fabulous episode, because it took a conflict in another place that was obvious to those people as a something over which they must struggle to the end, and made it appear ridiculous to an outsider. Mm-hmm. The outsiders come in, what are these people fighting about? They're all black on one side, white on the other.
You all look the same.
Exactly.
We're not the same,
because those guys are black on the left and we're black on the right. And so what seemed to the Star Trek crew a trivial difference was the difference of life and death for those people.
Yeah.
And so you get that juxtaposition. And of course, then that encourages you to think about, what is it in your society that you might be willing to go to the mat for? You think it's so important. And then somebody else look at it and say, what are you upset about? That's no big deal. And so just that introducing a perspective like that, that's what I want science fiction to do.
Yeah, that was a really good episode, just because it made you kind of... And it was, I think, especially edgy for like the height of the Cold War. Or maybe not the height, but, like, you know, especially the years of the Cold War, when, like, it was kind of
a nuclear apocalypse was a thing that could happen.
And it was kind of a faux pas to question, you know, whether or not we were in the right to be hating on the Russians, and if they really were our enemies.
Well, I agree with you that by questioning the Cold War, Roddenberry was a bit on the limb. But where Roddenberry really shone politically was his commitment to racial equality.
Mm-hmm.
And that shows so often in the show, and in Let That Be Your Last Battlefield, where you just can't watch that show and not conclude that that's clearly a metaphor for racial difference in America. Mm-hmm. And it would question question racial hierarchy.
And Sulu was one of the first Asian men to mm-hmm. appear on television who wasn't like either a mechanic or like a kung fu mm-hmm. mentor, and he had like actual romance interests, and like, you know, was actually kind of a sex symbol. So that was, you know, that was pretty impressive. And a lot of that was George Takei too. Just mm-hmm. for reference, Takei is amazing. I really love George Takei. What was your least favorite episode of the original series?
Yeah, let's get to
put you on the spot for this
favorite.
One.
Oh gosh. Well, there's some I really dislike the episodes in which Nurse Chapel was an idiot.
Ooh. Okay. I did hear episodes plural.
That episodes where what Nurse Chapel did was walk around and gaze longingly at Spock. I thought, what a come down for this woman. She should have been number two in the, if they'd gone by the original, what do you call that, the
the original pilot, the
pilot,
Cage.
Yeah, she would have had this great role in, as a leader, and instead she wears a miniskirt and longs after a guy who barely gives her the time of day. And I mean, she could have had a much more effective role than that. So,
in fairness, I feel like that would have been me if I was on that if I was on the Enterprise. I feel like I would have I would have been longing after Spock. Let me put it that way. But I totally get what you're saying. I actually wanted to ask.
Do you like wearing a miniskirt in the Enterprise?
Look, I have nice legs. All right, I need to show them off sometimes. And that kind of leads into, I wanted to ask you, what was it like watching Mudd's Women when it first aired? Because now that episode, looking at that episode now, I'm just like, who thought this was a good idea? But like, this was, you know, I'm not from the 60s. I don't know what things were like then. It was a different time.
Yeah, well, I actually think in this odd way, Mudd's Women was intended to be a blow for women's liberation, because the bottom line was that you didn't have to be conventionally beautiful to actually be beautiful, that the women didn't have to take the drug, and that it was okay for them to look as they looked. And so I think there was an effort to deliver that, but of course it was delivered by men. Mm-hmm. I mean, the women didn't figure it out.
No.
They had to be saved by the men, who had to reassure them that it was really okay. The women hadn't come to that conclusion themselves, except through the intervention of, you know, Kirk and all that.
Well, their life was nothing but that sort of serving men, right, being that consort, or like, so for minors, or so. At least that's what I understood the episode was, that they were, you know, being pimped out by Mudd to these various mining colonies, right?
Wow.
So that's what their life was. So it's like, what does a fish know? A fish knows to be in water.
Right,
so.
Exactly.
Yeah. I don't understand why.
I think it was more so that it was because they needed that outside perspective to go, this is like wrong. You don't need to do this. This is bad.
I don't understand why on earth they decided that Harvey Mudd needed to be a recurring character. I mean, was he popular? Like, did people like him?
I like Mudd.
You like? Oh, okay. All right.
In Star Trek Online, you can see one of his descendants.
Oh my goodness! Can you shoot one of his descendants?
Because maybe in the Foundry mission or something.
I'm considering buying Star Trek Online, so that I can shoot one of Mudd's descendants.
I'll make a Foundry mission just for you, Warren.
All right, you do that, Bob.
Where you shoot all of Mudd's family.
So, we've covered the original series a fair bit. So when Next Generation first started airing, you know, after this long period of no Star Trek, and then because, you know, the original series stopped airing in what, 1968?
I think it's
68. Yeah, and Next Generation
did 67, 68 was three seasons, I think.
Yeah, and then it reran for a little bit. And then, of course, Next Generation didn't start until 1987.
Twisted Mike in the chat, I think he's talking about Mudd, that he was everyone's favorite creep.
I suppose that's true. He was everyone's... He was definitely a creep.
I'm such a huckster guy, though. I like hucksters in stories.
I like Quark. Quark is my favorite huckster.
Yeah, Quark.
But, so, what was watching The Next Generation like after, you know, having only seen the original series?
Well, it was so great to have Star Trek back, you know, that all of us were heaved this great sigh of relief. Thank goodness, they've brought it back. It's, you know, and since I know it's colossally irritating to you who have such a refined critique, but for me, there is no bad Star Trek.
No, that's fair.
You
know?
And so
you look at Star Trek like people look at pizza.
Pizza. So I just totally loved it. Even though I can look back at it and I can see a lot of the early episodes, it was still kind of shaky. But it was great to have The Next Generation.
So you like was watching The Next Generation? Did it like was there like what immediately stood out to you as being different from the original series?
Well, they've substituted skin-tight clothes for miniskirts.
Okay, they did that.
everyone wore that skin-tight, like, uniform,
right,
though.
Right,
and, well, Troy did wear the miniskirt still in the first episode.
At first, that's
although
right.
Although so did a couple of guys, actually.
Yeah, that was utterly confusing to me when I first saw that when I was, like, 4 years old. And
I didn't
like,
notice.
What's happening, Dad? Why is the guy wearing a skirt?
I didn't notice that the first time I watched. I have to admit, I had to see it. I had to, like, you know, view it again in, like, my early 20s. And I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting.
Oh, no, I was subjected to that early.
Well, so was I, but I didn't notice it. Just for reference, I grew up on Star Trek The Next Generation. I was born in the same year that Star Trek The Next Generation aired. So, you know, three great things now came out of 1987. But, you know, so that was all I knew as a kid. I was confused to find out there were other television shows because, you know, we didn't have those in the house. And so, like, did you notice when, like, in, because I know I didn't notice this when I was first watching because I was a little kid, but did you notice how, like, after season two, The Next Generation got, like, really different and sort of moved away from the original series, like, ideal?
Yeah, you could really see that when Roddenberry was no longer in the mix, that the series changed. Those intimate little yuck it up on the bridge moments tended to disappear, mm-hmm. and there was a certain almost naivete or that's what makes it sound bad. I don't want to make it sound bad, but a kind of innocence to mm-hmm. the Roddenberry themes,
yeah.
that were appealing and was appealing, and so I kind of missed that. But I liked the exploration of kinds of people that are not strictly from one society or another, but are a blend. Mm-hmm. And of course, they'd started that with Spock, but Spock was the only one in the original who was not clearly from one place.
Right.
Right. And then, so you get Deanna Troi, who's half Beta Zed, and half Earth.
Half human.
Human. And Worf, who is all Klingon but raised by humans, and so culturally he's very much part human.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get Geordi, who's there's what I'm getting at here are characters in which there's a kind of many-ness in the character, a kind of multiplicity in the character. And with Geordi, the many-ness was the technology. The visor was a part of him,
mm-hmm.
and so he was a cyborg in that sense of a human machine. Merger.
All right. So I think that we've talked a little bit about that. I think it's a little time for some music.
Muzak.
Some Muzak. And when we get back, we will discuss Kathy's class, Political Theory at Star Trek, and the beautiful things it does.
Beautiful things it does. How do you like me some political science?
Political science is rad.
It is a wonderful thing. And we're back on All Things Trek.
We are indeed.
So, you know what I heard?
What are you?
I heard there's a contest going on.
Please tell me about this contest.
This contest. All right. So, what it is, you can go to our website,
uh-huh.
and you can donate.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter how much it is. It could be a dollar. It could be $50. It could be $150. Obviously, we like more money.
I like the third one a lot.
I think we all do. So, what will happen when you donate, this will enter you in for a chance to win a couple of tickets down to the Las Vegas convention happening this August.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And that sounds like a rad thing to do.
It is a rad thing to do. And you'll have a chance, or you will have dinner with Xander, Roxy, and Tosk, and a mystery guest.
Ooh. Who is the mystery guest?
You know, I actually don't know.
No, I don't know either.
They
don't tell us this kind of thing.
It's why it's a mystery. So, you know, that's the thing happening. So, and each donation, there's no limit how many times you can donate. Each donation you do does give you another chance to win those tickets. So you could donate, you know, a dollar 50 times if you want to, and that'll be 50 chances.
Ooh, that sounds like gaming the system.
Well, it's okay. We have $50.
That's fair.
They got 50 chances, so it's okay. If they want to go through the painstaking trouble of doing that one by one, which, yeah.
All right.
So where are we at? What are we doing?
Well,
we're interviewing Kathy Ferguson.
We are, indeed. And now that we've just talked about Star Trek in general, her views on Star Trek, I want to specifically talk about her class, Political Theory in Star Trek, which is a rad class, let me tell you. So, Kathy, tell us about what your students do in this class.
Well, this is a class that's actually a requirement for political science majors at my
university. Oh, my goodness.
Political science classes required for political science majors? You're blowing my mind.
And nobody else teaches it with Star Trek, but the class is about the history of Western political philosophy. So we start with Socrates and we go through to Nietzsche. And we basically do the top 10 of the most well-known people who are called in the canon, meaning in the major tradition mm-hmm. of Western thought. And so for each, I group them around common historical themes or conceptual themes. So we'll read Plato and Aristotle, and then we'll watch Star Trek. And then we'll read Augustine and Aquinas, and we'll watch Star Trek. And mm-hmm. then so on all the way through the class. And the idea is to find in Star Trek a working out of some of the key themes that these political philosophers have covered in their writings. So that will like it when we look at Machiavelli. Deep Space Nine is perfect for Machiavelli.
Oh, isn't it?
Since there's so much. There's so many
times. He was the guy who said it was better to be feared than loved, right?
That's right. Yep. Exactly. Very good. From The Prince. And Machiavelli was the guy who was basically writing an advice column to a ruler in very hard times. When what the ruler wanted to do was obviously often not available, and so he had to do other things.
I just want to let you know that Roka in the chat doesn't want to take your class.
Does or does not?
Does.
Oh, okay, great. That's cool.
So what you got to do is University of Hawaii, right?
University of Hawaii.
So go move to Hawaii and start taking classes there.
Yep.
That's how you do that.
Or if you go to Evergreen, you could do what I did, which is set up an independent contract for that. But that might not actually work.
I want to take a class about Star Trek. We don't do that.
So what episodes do you actually? What episodes do you use?
Well, one of the best for that class is The Measure of a Man, the Next Generation one where Data's on trial.
That's season two where Maddox wants to take him apart or something, like check out how he works. And
exactly.
You're like, oh man, I want to build a Data. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, do you have
Lieutenant
the research?
Jerk. No. Mm-hmm. Lieutenant
Commander. Commander? Yeah. I think it's Commander Jerk.
I thought maybe it was Lieutenant Commander. I don't know. Biggest jerk in Starfleet. I remember that.
But he had a lot of jerkdom behind him, right? Because the Star Trek was on his... I mean, Starfleet was on his side. The mm-hmm. officials were going to let him do it. So that episode is great for John Stuart Mill, because it's a lot about freedom of speech and about both John Stuart Mill and Aristotle had this idea that the way that what makes you fully human is your capacity to speak with others and to sort of stand up and say what you believe in and defend it and listen to other people and argue and mm-hmm. change your mind as you need to and then go on. That sort of public speech is fundamental to our humanity. Mm-hmm. They both thought that. And here's an episode where Data is doing that in his presentation in the courtroom. And Picard uses that and says, Data, what are you doing right now? And Data says, I'm on trial for this and that. Well, what's at stake on this and that? So you see Data making the speech that from Aristotle and Mill's position would affirm his humanity.
Yeah,
my mind is thoroughly blown now.
Do you get to use like my favorite line from that episode is when Picard says, "Prove to the court that I'm sentient."
Prove to the court that I'm sentient.
And Maddox just looks at him like, what?
Right. Well, I actually,
lol, lol.
Yeah, I do use that because.
Oh my gosh, you are right. Picard is a troll.
He's such a troll.
Oh.
We were having a discussion about this earlier, where John Stewart and Picard are trolls.
Aww.
But the that's a great line for calling people's attention to what Picard is showing, which is that every political argument has to take something for granted in order to go where it wants to go. There's no such thing as a political argument that lacks assumptions. And assumptions are, by definition, not demonstrated. They're what you have to assume in order to go where you're going, but
right.
they are not amenable to proof.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Picard calls attention to that, he shows the assumptions that are at work in the argument. And that's great.
So what are some other episodes that you use?
Well, my very, very favorite Star Trek, if I had to pick one, is Darmok.
Darmok?
And I use that for Nietzsche.
Darmok and Jalad for 2008.
Uh-huh. At Tanagra.
And I used the reason it's my favorite episode probably has a lot to do with Nietzsche being one of my favorite philosophers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great episode for showing Nietzsche's argument that language is not a vehicle for describing a reality that already exists. It's a vehicle for creating what we count as real. Language doesn't just describe the world, it helps constitute the world.
Oh my goodness. This is so much.
And you see that in this other society where they have created their society around a completely metaphorical language. Everything is metaphor. They communicate entirely through metaphor. And Nietzsche says, well, we think in our language, he was talking about not just German, but modern language, we think that we can distinguish between the literal and the figurative. That when I say, this class is a piece of cake, that's an expression. But if I say, I ate a piece of cake, that's literal. And we're all used to that, right? We think those are different.
I ate a class that is cake.
And
the cake is a lie.
So what Nietzsche says is you think there's a difference between the literal and the metaphorical, but what we think is literal is just metaphors we have gotten so used to that we don't know they're metaphors anymore. Mm. Their metaphorness is so hidden in the history of our language that they have become literal. But they started off as an expression because all language is metaphor.
Mm-hmm. Now, I really like that episode for reasons that are not nearly as cerebral as this. I really like that episode because it's like there are a lot of TNG episodes that are sort of, that people criticize as being, you know, well, if they had just fired on the mysterious object and blown it up, there wouldn't have been a problem. Like, you know, all the various probes they run into that just mess their ship up. If you just destroyed that probe when it first started acting weird, everything would have been fine. This episode is like kind of the reverse of that because the, what is it, the Tenagrans? Mm-hmm. I forget the name, the name of the species.
Yeah.
Talarians?
But their ship is significantly more powerful than the Enterprise. And so at the point when Riker does decide to resort to violence, the other ship, you know, just wipes the floor with them, and it's clear that it could have destroyed them if it wanted to. And so if they had, you know, if they had reacted with violence when their captain was first kidnapped, things would have gone really badly. And it's, you know, it's sort of the reverse of that episode. Or is it the reverse of that trope, and I really liked it for that reason.
I've got a question for you, Kathy. Mm-hmm. So in these episodes, like Darmok, for instance, where we see like these assumptions and whatnot at play, do you suppose the writers took that into consideration when they first created the episode, or was that something that we're looking at now later and see that as just an element? Yeah.
You know, I have only theories and speculations about that
because
I've never really studied these writers and seen where they were educated. But a part of me says that there's a bunch of unemployed political theorists writing for Star Trek, or rather newly employed as writers for Star Trek. They couldn't get academic jobs, and so they went off and wrote for Star Trek. That's one, you know, fancy I have in my mind. But I think a more likely way to think about that is that the themes in Western political theory are so much a part of our culture. They're so written into our narrative structure, the way we tell stories, how we understand an account to be made of something, that they're there to be tapped. It's like those are resources in the culture that these writers can tap because, I mean, I'm sure they went to college. They're educated people. They may not have ever sat down and said, let me see how I can use John Locke for Star Trek. But they didn't have to because John Locke's all over our culture. Mm-hmm. John Locke's ideas permeate our culture. And so they, to me, that's why Star Trek works. And that's why I've never found another science fiction series that would work for this class, because Star Trek just reaches into those iconic themes and just pulls them out and writes a story about them. And so it's the philosophical conceptions are always there to be found in Star Trek. They don't get lost in the action or in the character development. And Star Trek has those things, but those iconic themes always have a resonance.
Are you suggesting that Space 1999 would not have been appropriate for your class?
I couldn't find a lot of material there, no.
Space 1999. So, as I understand it, as I recall, the final project for your class, like the final paper, is to write an episode of Star Trek incorporating the philosophies of the people you've been studying.
Yep.
So tell us about that.
Well,
because that is my favorite part of this class.
That's a lot of fun, except for the students who think that they're being tortured.
How could anyone think that?
But
not everyone's like us, Warren.
They have to. Yeah. They have to write basically a 2-part paper in which they write their own Star Trek story. And it has to be their story. Now, they can build on another story. So, for example, they could go to... There's a lot of Star Trek stories that have this ending that makes you wonder, what happened next? You know, mm-hmm. like the Next Generation episode where Beverly is kidnapped by, quote, terrorists. The High Ground. Exactly. That's a great episode because at the end, the little boy doesn't shoot...
The
security woman, exactly. And so there's the suggestion that maybe the chain of violence will be broken. But then they don't ever come back to that planet. You have no idea what happened. So for my class, you could go back to that planet and you could write part two. Okay, what happens next? And the advantage is you've got your storyline going. But the disadvantage is you've got your storyline going and you have to stay with it. Right? So it limits you, but it also gives you direction. So they can do that or they can start from scratch. And most people start from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And they can mix and match. They can have Picard meet Spock and... then they go off and have a beer with Archer. I mean, I'm because they don't have to be Star Trek specialists to take this class. They just have to know enough about the Star Trek universe that they can write a story.
Well, to be fair, the episode Unity, where Picard did meet Spock, was an amazing two-part episode.
It's a fabulous episode.
Unification. Yes. Unification.
Sorry, Star Trek's lab.
You are correct. And in the IRC, Sleeves has said that Martin Lando, I think that was the guy who played the lead.
I'm actually going to... Let's go with what he typed, which is Martian Lado.
Lado?
Yeah, I have no idea who that is.
Kirk. I think he was the guy who played the lead in Space 1999, and that's a funny idea. Imagine that guy as Kirk.
I don't wanna. I don't wanna. You know, I think you would really like Star Trek Online's Foundry creator.
Yeah?
Yeah, which Star Trek Online is an MMORPG, which actually is... you know, one of the things that we here at Riser Radio actually kind of, you know, like we interface with, like this chat room, for instance, this is Star Trek Online people right now. But the Foundry actually allows you to create your own Star Trek missions if you want to. It's a little limited in some capacities, like, you know, NPC limits and whatnot, but there's some really good stories on there I think you'd appreciate and like. Yeah.
Sounds like fun.
I mean, it is a game still. I don't know how into gaming you are at all, but, you know, there's some good stories on there. I've made a couple you might like.
I would love to see them.
That does sound really interesting. What are, like, if you had to pick one now, what would be, like, your favorite of the episodes that your class has written?
I think one really stands out of this young man who failed the class the first time because he could not write a Star Trek story. And he just didn't get what he was supposed to do. And he was determined. And he came back a second time, and he could have taken it from somebody else who did not require the Star Trek, but he didn't. He came back to my class, and he took it a second time, and he aced it. He did so well. And what he did was he took a reading in the class. We read a philosopher named Hannah Arendt, and the woman writing about Hannah Arendt is a currently living, all the philosophers we read are dead, but the currently living person who wrote about Arendt is a well-known political theorist at the University of Michigan named Lisa Dish. So Ben, the student, in his story made Lisa Dish his main character, and she gets thrown through, you know, some kind of science fiction magic into the Star Trek universe. Ooh. And so then she walks through this universe as a contemporary political philosopher, raising questions that Hannah Arendt would have raised, or that Plato would have raised, or that Socrates would have raised, as a contemporary expression of those ideas. And it was brilliant.
This sounds too rad to not be a book series of some sort. I want to read this.
I don't remember. Congratulations to the student. Do you remember his name?
His name was Ben.
Ben. And, well, congratulations to Ben. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, he did a good job.
So, like, do you end up with a lot of students who don't know the Star Trek universe very well? I've always wondered about
There's got to be at least one or two.
Oh, my gosh, over half the class. The beginning of the class, I'll say...
Those uncultured swines.
How many of you have never seen a Star Trek? At least half the hands go up.
Ooh.
And it almost makes me want to stop teaching the class, because the original point of this was I was going to take a part of popular culture that was familiar to people and use it as a vehicle to get them to understand these hard political theories, because political theory is hard. It's hard to read this stuff.
Yes, it is.
And so I figure if you already know Measure of a Man, you've seen John Stuart Mill, John Locke, and Aristotle in action already, and actually in some Marx in there. But what I end up having to do is I have to teach them Star Trek, too. And then I have to teach them political theory. So it's like a double whammy here. But I can't quite give it up, so I still do it.
All right. Well, I wanted to ask you, we're coming up on the hour break, but I wanted to ask you just one more thing. What did you think of the new Star Trek movie?
Oh, I loved it.
You did?
Remembering, of course, that for me there's no bad Star Trek. There is still weak Star Trek, right?
Yeah.
And strong. And I thought it was great. And the reason I loved it is that I love that it opened up the narrative universe. That the narrative parameters of who came from where and what they could do because of the time shift was now you can just tell a whole bunch of new stories. And that's what I love about Star Trek. I love the capacity to tell new stories.
All right. Well, I think that's great. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.
We are going to break here, and when we come back, we will be talking about Star Trek video games, and we will definitely try to get Kathy back again at some point to talk more about Star Trek.
You're welcome to stay for the rest of the show.
Thank you.
You don't have to go anywhere.
Thank you.
Not by any
that.
Means. You know, it's, God, or kicking your own mom out of the broadcast booth.
No, it's not happening. We're staying.
Such a rude young man.
Indeed. But for this break, we have something very special. We have the second episode of Star Trek Tales from the DMZ. This episode is entitled Aftermath. and it picks up right after the end of our last episode. For those of you who either didn't hear the last episode or don't know much about the DS9 universe, this is about a crew of a Maquis raider and the adventures that they have. The Maquis are a group of resistance.
Or misadventures.
Misadventures. are a group of they're a group of resistance fighters against the Cardassians, or terrorists, depending on what side of the conflict you happen to be on. It features...
creative freedom fighters.
Yes. It features voice acting talents from Michelle Heiner as Save, Jonathan Preshaw as Andars, Ari Ashkenazi as Tarek, Brianna Salvleski as Maria, and we also have, today we have guest starring three people, actually. We have Elliot Bangs.
I could listen to him read the phone book.
Elliot Bangs has an amazing voice. We have Kelsey Sorge Tume, which is probably the best name ever. And then we have our own Bob Collins, also playing a guest voice. So
I can choke really well.
He's choked really well. All right, Bob, make it happen.
I am making it happen.
I think we've lost them.
Save, listen to me. Listen to my voice.
I could use some help here.
Save has a concussion. I need to keep her awake.
Tarek, what the hell is that?
I had to dust in the antimatter pods. They were about to blow.
Yep, there they go.
Save, I need you to say something. Tell me where you were born.
The planet Vulcan, Kandar Hospital, 2250. You may return to your station, Maria. Have sufficient concentration to remain conscious.
Comms out. We have about 5 minutes of power left.
We need to land somewhere.
Braxnal is the only M-class planet in range.
The Maquis have no bases on Braxnal.
No choice. I'm taking her down.
Here, try to reach these coordinates. There's a small state outside Avalanche City we can land at.
I got it. Now make sure the engines last that long.
We're about to hit the atmosphere.
Half my indicators are dead. How's the hull temperature?
Going up fast. 1900 degrees Kelvin.
Execute a braking maneuver at 10 kilometers above the surface.
That was half a kilometer ago. Hold on!
Hello? Anyone alive in there? Hello?
Uncle, she needs help.
Well, you'd better get her inside. Is anyone else hurt?
No, we're fine. Anders, help me.
There's a couch in the front room. Let me get the med kit.
On three. One, two, three!
In here.
Gently now.
What do you think I'm trying to do? There. You're a lot heavier than you look, Save.
Vulcans have a very dense bone structure.
All right, let me take a look. Yep, she has a concussion and a few cracked ribs. This should help. But she needs rest. No moving around.
Your advice is quite logical.
Thank you so much.
Don't mention it. Friends of my nephew are welcome here.
Nephew?
Right. Everyone, this is my Uncle Lanin.
Wonderful. How long until you can fix the ship?
Parts are the problem. Half the impulse engine needs to be replaced, and don't even ask me about the warp engines.
There's a base near here we can get to on impulse.
We shouldn't be talking about this in front of him.
Don't you worry about me. I already know plenty about the Maquis.
You're one of us?
Nope, just a really good listener. Now, why don't you tell me what happened?
We were ordered to defend Nigel Station from a Cardassian attack. There were just too many of them.
Let's not be modest. They set a trap and we walked right into it.
We barely made it out.
That's quite a tale. That'll be port control wanting to know why there's an unauthorized spaceship in my yard. I'll see if I can straighten them out.
We must leave this planet as soon as possible. Anders, Maria, go into the city and get the parts we need. There's a supply of latinum in my cabin. Tarek, make them a list.
Right away.
What if we can't afford the parts?
Improvise.
Well, I've convinced them not to send out an inspection team, but they are slapping me with half a dozen fines.
Thank you. We will repay you as soon as we are able.
It's times like this I miss living in Federation proper. No fines there.
We need to get into town. Can you help us?
Sure. Take one of my hover cars. Transporter network's been shut down since the Maquis started duking it out with the Cardassians.
Thank you.
Be careful, though. Braxnell is a shared planet. The Cardassians maintain an outpost north of town.
We'll be careful.
Here's the list. Important stuff's at the top.
This way, then.
Once they return, how long until you can repair the ship?
A few hours, less if I start now.
Then get to work.
Right.
Well, they're on their way.
Thank you. We won't impose upon you any longer than we have to.
You could repay me by telling me something about my nephew.
This is only our second mission. I can tell you that he's a Betazoid and a competent engineer.
Does he seem like a typical Maquis recruit?
People join the Maquis from all walks of life.
I suppose they do.
It's a little convenient that Tarek just happened to have an uncle on this planet.
Now let's not start that. A lot of us have family all over the DMZ. People here get displaced all the time.
And how many of your relatives have hover cars to spare and influence with port control?
Let's be glad he did.
Did you know Tarek's a Betazoid?
Really? Huh.
That's right. I looked up his personnel file. He never mentioned he can read minds.
I've never met a Betazoid engineer before.
Never mind. There's the shipyard.
I hope 2 bars of latinum will be enough.
Keep your phaser handy if it isn't. Hello, hello! What can I do for you?
You'll have to give us a minute. We need to find another yard.
There's no time for that. What's wrong with you?
The owner is a Cardassian.
So? He needs latinum just as much as the next man.
He'll sell us out.
Only if you keep acting suspicious. Here, let me handle this. My apologies. We need these parts to repair our ship.
Let me see. This shouldn't be a problem. Won't be cheap, though.
How much?
For all this, 2.5 bars of latinum.
Can you make it 1.5 if we give you the scrap parts we're replacing?
Maybe, like, the whole yard while you're at it.
Hey, this is tritanium. Don't scoff.
Just testing you. I could go with 2 bars.
Deal. That's our hover car out front.
Just let me go get the paperwork.
And that's how it's done.
Get your phaser.
What?
There's a Cardassian patrol coming up the road.
Have they seen us?
Don't know.
Just stay calm and wait for them to pass.
They've seen us.
Damn it!
What's going on?
We have to make a run for the hover car.
Okay.
Now, come on!
We're cut off.
They're coming in through the back!
Take them alive!
Just one more stem bolt. There.
We have a problem.
I'm coming. Uncle, what's wrong?
I just got word from town. Your friends have been captured by the Cardassians.
What are we going to do?
Rescue them.
Right. How?
I'm still considering that. Where are they being held?
Most likely the Somar outpost north of town.
An outpost like that should have, at most, 3 dozen soldiers.
Well, that'll be easy.
What is the status of the ship?
It won't fly. Most systems are offline.
What is functioning?
Let's see. Minimal life support, navigation, the port side phasers, the transporter, but that won't help us. Cardassians will have the whole place covered with transporter scramblers.
Perhaps. What if you knew their command codes and frequencies?
Then I could beam Maria and Anders out easily, but that's not... Why are you looking at me like that?
At what distance can you employ your telepathic abilities?
A few meters, but I don't...
Then we need only devise a method of getting you that close to the Cardassian commander.
Wait a minute. I've never been very good at telepathy. Uncle, maybe you could.
No.
But it would be easy for you.
And I won't do it. I'll help you any way I can, but not that.
As you wish.
Savay, I don't think I can do this.
You will have to. Your uncle is not one of us. And with my injuries, I will only slow you down.
No. This is not what I signed up for. I fix engines. I'm not a commando. It has to be someone else.
There is no one else, Tarek. Without you, Anders and Maria will die.
Tell me what to do.
Damn Cardassians. Since when did they set their disruptors on stun? Maria, are you awake?
Yes. Do you know where we are?
Probably in the outpost north of the city. Careful what you say in here. The Spoonheads are probably listening to us right now. That's why they put us in the same cell.
I understand.
Are you missing a tooth?
No.
Me neither. They haven't processed us yet.
Why is he here?
The yard owner? Standard Cardassian procedure. Round up everyone who might be connected with the suspects. Hey, wake up!
Oh, what happened? Where am I?
Prison suite. First class.
No, there's been a mistake. Can you hear me? There's been a mistake. I don't belong in here.
Give it a rest. They don't care.
I'm a loyal citizen of Cardassia. I served 4 years in the Fifth Order. Golpadar himself will vouch for me. You can't put me in here with these terrorists.
Welcome to Cardassian justice.
How could I have been so blind? Bajara walks into my yard and wants to buy spaceship parts. Where else could you have been? If I'd reported you on sight, I wouldn't be in here.
Believe me, you're not the only one who regrets that.
I'm ruined. They'll never let me out of here.
Dreadful shame.
Shut up. If I have one comfort, it's that you terrorists are here with me. At least my children will be safer for it.
The Maquis do not target children.
I suppose you were behind the bombing in Keldon City? How many?
And you? You served in the Fifth Order. Were you with them at Salva II? Did you watch them obliterate half the colony from orbit? Did you fire the disruptors yourself?
Come on, Maria. That's enough.
I didn't! Please!
I said that's enough. Let him go.
Thank you. Thank you.
What's wrong with you, Maria?
Nothing.
That remains to be seen. I'm Glenn Ekman of the Third Order. You are both under arrest for your suspected status as Maquis terrorists.
At last, someone who can see reason. Please, I didn't know who they were.
You would do well to keep silent. The courts will determine your involvement.
But I haven't done anything.
Mijan Anders, Maria Belmont, if you confess to your crimes and provide me with information that leads to other members of the Maquis, you will both be handed over to your native governments.
Go to hell.
As you wish. Don't say I didn't give you a way out. Take them for processing.
That's right, we're back here at All Things Trek. Myself, DJ Bob.
DJ Oren.
That's right. We're here to talk about some more stuff, namely some Star Trek games.
Yeah, and we think this is probably going to be a long conversation that will probably stretch into next week's episode, because there are a lot of Star Trek games.
There are a lot of Star Trek games. A lot of them can be summed up pretty well, though, I think.
Yeah, some of them are really fast. Oh, and also we hope you enjoy Tales from the DMZ Aftermath, yep. Part 1.
I can choke really well.
Yeah, Bob chokes really well.
Put that on my resume now.
And Episode 2 will eventually show up at some point. Episode 2, Part 2. Aftermath Part 2 will eventually show up at some point in the future. These things take a long time to sound edit.
It's true. But at least we got some good voice actors.
We did get some really good voice actors, so thank you to all of them.
All of them. Not just part of them.
No, not part of them. Not just their voices.
Exactly. So, some Star Trek games. Also, if you want to mention any of these Star Trek games at all, or some that we don't mention, just please speak up in the chat, because we'd love to talk about them. But some of the ones I want to talk about first is everything made before 1990.
You mean Kill Klingons?
Kill Klingons. That's all it was. There was one. There was... God, what was it called? I want to say Promethean Prophecy.
That sounds familiar.
It was still a text-based game where you beam down to a planet and you got like solve problems and stuff. It was very linear, text-driven.
Mm-hmm.
It had something to do with the Romulans. It was so long ago, I can't even remember. But it was so bad because I don't think it was like an actual writer that had like done it. Like you see with some of the later Star Trek games, there was like actual like. Of course, a lot of those older games kind of had like one or two or maybe like five people behind them in the development team because it was like one guy with like basic writing it out.
Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of team so much as group.
Yeah, so I mean, it was just so poorly written. But every game before 1990 was all about flying around as Captain Kirk on the Starship Enterprise, blowing up invading Klingon fleets. If you're not blowing up Klingons, what are you doing? Get out there and start blowing up Klingons.
You're not doing it wrong. Klingons need to be blown up.
They do. I mean, they kind of got a bit of a bad rap, I think, before 1990.
Well, that's true. Before they were reimagined. because originally they were just kind of cardboard cutouts of communism, was what they were originally for. They were just stand-ins for the Soviet Union. And they weren't really very, you know, and they didn't have, like, because of budget constraints, they couldn't have a lot of makeup, so they just, you know, were people with, like, gold lame, and they typically tended to have darker skin than humans did, and sometimes they looked vaguely Asian. But there were only, like, one or two episodes where we saw the Klingons had anything going for them other than a wanton need to kill.
That's true.
There were a couple, but not much. So, like, until Next Generation happened, and then we were able to see that maybe the Klingons weren't all evil, and so the idea of having a game where all you did was kill Klingons for no reason suddenly seemed a lot less, you know, a lot less kosher. Klingons were no longer the zombies of Star Trek.
That just actually went to the Borg, who were literally zombies.
Yes. The Borg became the new zombies of Star Trek, but they were so powerful that you couldn't just have a game about blowing up the Borg, because no one would believe it. Or you can, and there are a few where they do that, but we'll talk about those when we get to them.
Yes, exactly. So you know what year the first, at least as far as my research could tell, the first Star Trek quote-unquote video game was made?
What was it?
1971.
What?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. And no. Kathy's got a look on her face like, what? I missed that on this?
I cannot be. The Star Trek video games can't be older than me.
Well, it was a text game is what it was. I think it might have been using, like, punch cards or so. Or, like, I don't know if it was a slide abacus or something they were using. Or
punch cards to play a Star Trek game?
Well, yeah. And the way it was described is that you were given just, like, a ship status report. And what was, like, on sensors through these, like, either it was text or punch card. I'm not really sure which one it was, but given like a ship status report, what's on sensors, weapon status, ship status, things like that, and then you fed orders back in saying, I want you to turn the ship such, fire these weapons at ship, or scan, or do different things, and then it would put out another output saying how what had changed in the next report.
Huh.
I think it was the PD-10 or something like that. It was one of those computers that takes up like a whole room.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's or a good, like, you know, several closets anyway.
Yeah, definitely.
One of those, like, giant vacuum computers.
Tubes.
Yeah. Well, I don't know actually what's powering or not.
Man, that sounds kind of like that sounds like the 70s version of Bridge Commander. It sounds kind of like
which it. Which I do want to mention you can't beat, apparently.
No, I can't. I'll tell you about my horrible Bridge Commander experiences later.
Oh, yeah. I look forward to that. Anyway, so yeah. And then we moved on to more graphical user interfaces when the 80s came around. Like, the one I remember specifically playing was actually just called Star Trek, quite literally. All these games are called Star Trek.
The Enterprise was like 20 entire pixels. It was pretty rad.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. But there was actually, like, graphic user interface where you could see, like, the sector of space you were in, how many Klingon ships there were, if there was a starbase nearby you could go to. But the actual gameplay didn't change much. I mean, you still had, like, a ship status report, but the speed of which you could do it, I think, was probably a lot faster.
Mm-hmm.
Because you were like, oh, man, I push buttons and things are happening on the screen. Ooh, innovation. You know, it was pretty cool. Anyway, that was like, the first Star Trek game I had ever played in the Commodore 64 when I was, like, that tall, which this, approximately 3.5 feet tall for those that can't see what I'm doing with my hands.
Ooh, that's 3.5 foot tall, Bob. That sounds like something that would have been
for my parents, it was. From there, we move on to 1992.
Oh, I have memories of this game.
Yeah, Star Trek, the 25th anniversary.
We had this game on, like, the first desktop computer.
Did you play it, Kathy, at all?
No, I watched him play it.
You watched him play it?
Yeah, but we had this game on the first computer that we had in the house. The first desktop computer. It was running, like, what was it, Windows 3.11? Like, the one that preceded 95.
That was, like, Windows 3.1 or so.
Yeah. And so we had Star Trek 25th Anniversary Edition, and it started off with this, like, you know, this test battle against the
USS Republic.
Which is a lot of fun, although at this point I didn't really understand that it was a test battle. I thought they were just attacking me. So I had this thing where, like, I didn't want to fire first, because I knew that the good guys never fire first, so I would just wait for them to shoot at me, and then I would start fighting, which always put me at a bit of a disadvantage.
You know, read text dialogue boxes?
No.
That game had sound, too. Like, the voice actors were there and whatnot as well, and they were, like, explaining what was happening.
This may actually have been before I learned to read.
I'm not sure I'm comfortable with you in command of a starship if you don't know
how to read. I learned to read in fourth grade, okay? I don't remember exactly when that was, but I don't know what grade I was in 1992 off the top of my head, but this may have been before I learned to read. So, like, you started off with that, and then you could, like, warp to other planets, but all the planets except the one you were supposed to go to were full of Romulan and Klingon ships, And you blew one up.
What were the pirates called? Alasi.
Alasi? I don't even remember those
There
guys.
Were just, like, pirates that just, like, hung out also, like the Klingons and Romulans did, mm-hmm. other planets, and, like, if you wandered in their space, they'd be like, and you knew all of them on first-name basis, mm-hmm. or I guess in Kirk's, like, I guess a last-name basis, because like, you shouldn't have come here, Kirk. God. So no matter what, you know all the Alasi pirates ever in the universe.
They all knew Kirk, and like, but, like, you know, and they would just blow you up. If you managed to blow up one of them, they would just summon friends. So, you know, it was... Technically, you didn't have to follow the story, but if you didn't, you would explode.
it's true. So unless you could fight them all off really well, which...
No, but they just called friends. Like, there was... I thought there was an endless stream of them.
Oh, when you warp into a system, you get, like, maybe one... You get 1 to 5, I think, is the total.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, that's at least my experience was. And I had the wherewithal to fend them all off and whatnot, and then warp to where I needed to be. And such, which really consisted of alt-tabbing outside of the game to the actual game manual that came on the disc, because there was no labeling whatsoever in the game. It's like, you need to warp to the Pollock system to go to, like, the navigation map, and nothing is labeled.
Nope.
It's like, okay, so, where's Pollock's? Mr. Chekhov, I need to get to Pollock's. Read the manual, sir. The Star Chart and Star Trek manual.
That sounds like something Chekhov would say.
It probably is, you know, but that's what that was. I really liked the game, though, because it was one of my first experiences with good story-driven, like, gameplay. It was still just a point-and-click adventure with the space combat simulation part of it, where you're flying around and destroying other ships. And even though it was very linear, it was my first interactive experience with the Star Trek universe. Mm-hmm. That told good story, because it was still the original series, you know, like adventure type storytelling. I thought it was really awesome.
You say it was a good story. I'm going to take your word for it, because I could not get past the opening, like the first, like within like the first few panels of going down onto the planet you're supposed to go down. You come up against this wall of rocks, and you have to use your phaser to clear away the rocks. But I would shoot one rock, and it would roll. The rest would roll down and kill my red shirt.
So you're shooting at the wrong rock.
And then, like, I wasn't allowed to advance. I couldn't shoot any more rocks. And I don't know. I actually remember, and maybe I'm just making this up, but I remember Spock telling me, "Sir, we can't shoot any more rocks."
I think you're just pointing your phaser in the wrong direction.
But, like, I could not get past that part. I never figured out how to get past it.
But we'll get a hold of a copy or so. I'm going to sit you down and play through it.
Make me relive all my childhood trauma.
I will, that's
right.
I
wanted to play this game so bad, and I never could.
It's true. Now, there was a game the following year, made also by Interplay, in 93, mm-hmm. called Judgment Rites. And it was pretty much, I don't know if you want to call it a sequel so much, but it takes place after the 25th anniversary, where it's still more missions. I think it's still just another 7 missions, which is how long the 25th anniversary was. Mm-hmm. But this one also featured an ongoing story arc for several of the missions.
Oh, really?
So there's actually some continuity between missions as opposed to just one-off adventures, like the first one had, which is the 25th anniversary. Which I appreciated, because, you know, it's just like, oh man, ongoing story arcs. It's like, ooh, we can tell a story across multiple episodes.
What I did last time actually mattered. Was Judgment Rites still about the original crew?
It was still the original series crew. You still had all the voice talent there. The space combat was a little better.
Huh, yeah.
Not by much, though, because we're still talking, like, you know, MS-DOS. We don't Windows 3.1 interface.
It was funny when I was first playing the space battles. It was funny because I would fire the phasers, and it was these two, like, little red dots of light, and I thought those were torpedoes, because I'd been watching The Next Generation, and torpedoes were red in The Next Generation, and phasers were yellow.
That's like, when you right-click, and
yeah,
torpedoes
when I fired
come
the
out.
Torpedo, it was this giant ball of blue, and I was like, what is that?
What is this thing that is coming out of here?
What did I just fire out of my ship?
Yeah. Then, we get to Final Unity by Microprose in 95, and this game was kind of more of the same, and it was starting to get a little bit stale, where it was this linear path of gameplay, where you're just kind of going through dialogue boxes, and there's still the space simulation fight part of it that you can do. Now, it did try to do some branching dialogue, but it wasn't robust enough to get anywhere. Oh, was a thing.
That's, you know, too bad.
It is too bad. I mean, at the time, it was kind of like, you know, oh man, I can, the story will change. Ooh, oh man, this is exciting. Oh, but now it's like we look at it and be like, yeah, that's dumb.
So in case you guys,
in actuality, when I was playing it, I thought it was dumb too, because it didn't actually change anything. Because, you know, I play games more than once, some people who just like play it once and they're done.
If you guys can't tell, Bob knows way more about this than I do. I'm sitting here desperately trying to put some relevance into my comments. And he's actually played all these games and done all this research.
Not all of them. There's one or two in here, baby, that I haven't played. There's actually a bunch later on after we get to the 20 aughts.
No, man,
after the year 2000, there's actually some I haven't played.
The 20-aughts are when I started my Star Trek video gaming run.
See, that's, you say that, but you didn't play Bridge Commander, and I had to force it on you.
I didn't play Bridge Commander, and now I'm playing it, and there's a Romulan Warbird, and I am dealing with it.
You are dealing with it, it's true. Final Unity, it also didn't really do very well, like, critically, just because it was more of the same that we'd seen with, like, 25th Anniversary and Judgment Rites, where it was, you know, like, oh man, there's just linear story path, this is cool, I guess. Also, there was only one story. It was a longer story, granted, but it wasn't, like, better.
Also,
like, it didn't improve on what had come before.
Judgment Rites is also a really cool name, whereas Unity is not a really cool name. Yeah.
Final Unity was actually Next Generation Crew as well.
Was it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. That's cool. I like games set in the Next Generation era for some reason. I don't know.
Well, maybe you'll like Final Unity. I didn't like
it. There aren't that many of them. Most of the games tend to take place in the original series, or, like, in the movies.
Yeah. I mean, I don't remember much of the story. I think it had something to do with fighting Romulans.
Well, Romulans do need to be fought.
It's true. Of course, you're terrible at that.
Yep, I am really bad at that. Well, look, you know what I'm good at? I'm good at things Picard does. I'm good at tricking the Romulans with my Klingon allies and, you know, and out-talking them. I'm not good at actually fighting them.
Oh, oh man, bluff. you're going to be sadly disappointed with a lot of these Trek games then.
Oh, my goodness.
There's a lot of them are centered around fighting and whatnot. Of course, you did play Borg, though, right?
I actually didn't ever play Borg, but I watched several reviews of it. I was kind of fascinated by Borg, the game Borg, which is
there's actually two games that are like this, which is there's Star Trek Klingon, and then there's also Star Trek Borg.
Wasn't Klingon the board game? Like, there was, I feel kind of silly for not looking up the name of this beforehand, but there was a board game that came with a video, and there were, like, for a while in the mid-90s, this was like a craze that board games went through of coming with a cassette tape.
You like fast forward at different parts, and there's like different parts.
And
of
there was a Star Trek one of those, and the plot was that you were like four like junior officers who were on the Enterprise when it was like everyone else was off of it for a refit, and some Klingon crazy guy took over the ship and was going to like launch an attack on Kronos to start a war between the Federation and the Klingon Empire, and like you had to try to get to the bridge to disable him.
Well, I didn't play this Star Trek Klingon here that I have on the notes. But that sounds rad.
I don't know what it was called, but it was it was actually really cool. It was kind of goofy at some points. But my favorite part was that at some point, if you were the lowest ranking officer, you could leave. No, that was great.
Just
like,
desert your post.
Yeah, about halfway through the game, you would be playing the movie, and the Klingon guy would come on the screen and be like, "Hello, Starfleet officers. I know you were trying to regain control of the ship, but I will allow one of you to leave. I have activated the shuttle bay. The lowest ranking among you may get on the shuttle and leave."
This doesn't sound like something a Klingon would do.
I don't know why.
It sounds like something a Romulan would do.
I know that it was really...
And they capture them later when they're in the shuttle.
And of course, we'd all be like, no, we'll stay at our post. Except my dad. My dad was playing. He'd be like, no, I'm leaving. I don't want to be on this crew.
I'm out.
I don't want to be on this crew when the rest of you blow up.
Would you stay, Kathy, or would you leave?
I think I'd have to stay.
You'd have to stay just because you feel your Starfleet duty would compel you to stay there.
It was funny. It was so weird to have a game giving me an option to stop playing before I was done. And let me tell you, we lost that game a whole lot. And I actually got really upset when I was a kid because I didn't really like, you know, I wasn't really sure about the differences between what was happening in this game versus what was happening in the original show. And I think at some points I was actually like half convinced that if I lost this game, the Enterprise would be destroyed and I wouldn't be able to watch the next generation.
Oh man.
And that made me so sad. Sometimes we would cheat. Sometimes I would be like, you know, we'd be like, "You've lost this important role." I'd be like, "No," and I would rewind the video and do it again. And I would be like, "You can't stop me, Klingon. You're just a voice in a machine."
Gotcha. But anyway, what it sounds like with that one, which I thought was a video game, it might be this Star Trek Klingon, maybe something else. The research I had looked at was not what you're suggesting with this one, but was similar to Star Trek Borg, where it was like you're watching an episode of Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
And at certain points, you'd be given the option to go ahead and make a choice of some sort. Like in the instance of Borg, you have Q come in, and he's like, "Oh man, I can help you avenge your father who died in Wolf 359. Doesn't that sound cool? Let's go do that." And you have the option of either not going or going.
What happens if you don't go?
If you don't go, the game just ends right there.
Well, and I love games that give you the option to not play.
But any choice you make, though, it was kind of a false choice was the thing. Because any choice you made and you make the wrong decision, Q would just go, "No, you're retarded. You're going to do this instead. You're going to do this because that's a dumb choice you just made. You're going to do this instead." It's like, oh, okay. we're doing this now.
So, I was impressed that they were able to get, like...
That or you just died and were sent back to your start point anyway.
Yeah, well, because that was explained by Q taking you back in time. I was impressed that they could actually get John Delancey for that game. Like, he actually, you know, he actually did all the Q stuff.
Well, I mean, this is the mid-90s we're talking about here, which board came out in 96, I think. So we have a lot of... We have DS9 going on still. Voyager is still going. We have First Contact came out that year.
Really? So,
yeah.
First Contact was 96?
96, and then 98 was Insurrection.
Darn. I don't remember First Contact being
there
at all.
There was so much Trek in the mid-90s. So it wasn't really... I don't know how hard it was, but there wasn't... I would think, anyway, there wasn't too much red tape to get... actors like John Delancey or like Patrick Stewart or even like William Shatner or Leonard Nimoy to do voiceovers for these games or to appear as the characters in these games because it was so relevant at the time.
Yeah.
You know, just because people were going, oh man, Star Trek's relevant. Oh, dollar signs. Ooh. So they'd be like, yeah, you go do this thing.
I do really like the point in Borg where you, in order to get the correct access codes, you actually need to get assimilated. So you can get the access codes, and then Q will transport you back in time before you got assimilated, and then you can use the codes.
Yeah.
I don't remember if that was the only way to pass that point, but I thought that was neat.
Those Q doesn't play fair. But I definitely was very, very frustrated when this game first came out, and I played it, and I would just make the wrong decisions, which I thought were the right decisions at the time, and have Q berate me over them. It was just like, oh, John Delancey tells me I'm a bad person.
When John Delancey says it must be true.
It must be true. That's right.
It makes me kind of sad that was, like... it seems so petty for Q to be doing something like this. I mean, I know that Q is, like, interested in the growth of humanity, depending on what view you take of Q's character. It's just hard for me to see him being, like, this involved in one ensign and his, like, quest for vengeance against the Borg. It seems so un-Q.
Well, you know... Gameplay. It wasn't really a good game. I don't really consider it a game either, so much as a choose your own adventure like book that was done in the Star Trek universe, then shoved into the computer screen.
Yeah, it's like, is it a game? Is it a book? Is it a movie? What is?
Because I really felt like I was just watching an episode of Star Trek, albeit kind of a bad one. But it was what it was. Now we get to one of my other favorite games, which is Starfleet Academy in 97.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure a lot of people also go, oh man, I played that game, it was so rad.
I tried to play that game, I couldn't get it to run on the dinky little laptop we were using at the time.
In 97, you were trying to run games on a laptop?
Yep.
That was your problem right there, man.
Yep. We didn't have money for a desktop at that point. It wasn't happening. But I wanted to. I was so sad that I couldn't play this game.
Oh, you have every right to be sad, because it was pretty good. I mean, we hadn't seen anything like it before. I mean, it's a flight combat simulator still, where you are the captain of a starship, sort of. You're a cadet in training at Command College, quote-unquote, is what they call it. Which is really just Starfleet Academy, and you're a command recruit.
Mm-hmm.
You play the part of Cadet Forrester.
Mm,
and you're like,
Forrester.
Yeah, and you're going through like the motions of like, you know, if you were a captain, this is the situations you'd be put in. Go ahead and solve these situations. And it had some good functionality to it, I felt, where you could still talk to people. You could diplomatize your way out of situations. It all took place on the bridge still.
Mm-hmm.
So you sat in the bridge in your command chair and you barked orders out, similar to kind of how Bridge Commander was, where you can go to the different stations and modify things and whatnot. But you were still very much in control of the ship without the keyboard. You could actually use a joystick if you wanted to.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which I use the joystick all
Joysticks
the time.
Joysticks are like lost technology now. I can't remember the last time I saw someone with a joystick at their computer.
I play the Rainbow Six games with a joystick.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, that's interesting.
Well, I mean, because it's just, it feels a little more natural. I mean, that's how I first started playing the Rainbow Six games as well, with the joystick, because I felt like an actual, like, pistol grip gun.
Huh.
Yeah, with the trigger and whatnot. But yeah, you could play with a joystick if you wanted to, which I always did. It was really fun in Starfleet Academy to go into the kind of, like, I guess free play mode, I guess you'd call it. You could set up a battle where you have, like, your side and their side, and you can have what starships you want on your side, and then the starships on the other side. Oh, it was like being, it was a really, really tiny, like, fighter craft. It had nothing but two phaser banks, but they recharge really, really fast. So you're like this little gnat zipping around, like
pew, pew, pew.
Yeah, and you can use the joystick for that, and it was really cool. I appreciate it.
Oh, man. Apparently, DJ Rockwell in the DJ chat is saying that he uses a joystick for space combat in Star Trek Online.
Well, yeah, there you go.
That's amazing. That's cool. Congratulations.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't use a joystick myself for Star Trek Online, but... I have used an Xbox 360 controller for the ground combat, though.
Oh, what? Oh, my goodness. This is blowing my mind. You're plugging hard drives into other things, pieces of hardware into other hardware that it's not designed to go into.
Ooh, but the 360 controller is totally PC compatible.
Is it?
Yes. Oh. It's like one of the selling points.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Well, this
it's
is,
just USB.
Welcome to my understanding of computers and electronics.
Well, you know.
What year is it? What are we doing? Where do I find the internet, guys?
There's a Luddite, Warren.
In my day, things were different.
We're the same age, Warren.
In my day, things were... You're the one who has our email address as Hotmail. Don't tell me
you know,
about Luddites.
It's what I could do. It's the thing I did.
Okay.
All right, so Starlight Academy is pretty rad. And then we get to Generations.
Oh, man.
And we all know how everyone loves the movie Generations so much. But the game... Well, insert sarcasm here. Generations, based on the movie, actually was, I thought, a pretty good game. And here's why.
Okay.
It operated like a lot like a first-person shooter. It still had the space combat part where you could give orders to, like, Worf and the Helmsman and be like, hey, close on target, fire and stuff. Then there's the first-person shooter part of it where you're on, like, a station or a planet exploring, shooting people that aren't you, generally, mm-hmm. which is everybody.
Yep. Everyone you hate.
Yep. And then also had branching gameplay.
Yeah, that's a big word. Explain what that means.
Branching gameplay. All right, so, you know, in Generations, how the movie unfolded is they went to Amagosa. went to the station. Soren launched the device after they, like, cleaned up the mess and whatnot, blew up the sun, and then he immediately went to Verdian 3, right? Mm-hmm. And that's how the story goes. In Generations, it's a little different. You have the map, which is in stellar cartography, and you have... like a lead of where he's going to be going next. And it wasn't Viridian 3 that he went to next in the game. There were several different places he could go. There was one where there's a place where, like, these two sides have been devastated by war. He wants to blow up that sun. Mm-hmm. Or you could go to Glorndon Core, where he where he's in league with the Romulans, who built a secret base there.
Wait, didn't he steal trilithium from the Romulans?
He did.
Did they not?
Well, the Klingons did. Lursa and Bator.
Okay, so they don't know. He's tricky like that.
He is tricky like that. You can also go to... actually, go to a Klingon station, where he's there trying to launch a probe, which essentially it boils down to is that there's... The game takes liberty that there are several different stars he could have blown up to alter the trajectory of the Nexus so he can get into it. And there's a whole bunch of different endings that you could get on this. Like, one ending is where he actually makes it back on board the star drive of the Enterprise after it separates from the saucer. And you play as Picard, and you can go through and get him where he's in the torpedo bay trying to rig up a trilithium torpedo to send out towards the star. What I didn't understand about that, though, not so much him going back, because that part kind of made sense, was that there was this strange growth stuff suddenly all over the ship.
What?
Yeah, like, you saw the Alien movies, right?
Yes.
It was like that, but, like, pink.
Why?
I don't know.
Just
it was never
suddenly,
explained.
For no reason, the Enterprise was growing pink?
Yeah, I think it was really just kind of more of an effort to get, like, something for you, the player, to, like, shoot at that wasn't Soren.
So there were just monsters.
There were just monsters.
Oh my goodness. I'm having a really hard time envisioning what you're saying, because it just seems so weird.
I'll see if I can find some screenshots for you a little later here. But, I mean, it was just really something for you to shoot at, is what it was, and to give you obstacles. But I thought Generations really good, because it introduced this branching, actually, like, truly branching gameplay mm-hmm. for Star Trek games, which kind of, unfortunately, is sadly missing in a lot of other games that we get.
There really aren't any. I can't think of another example of that, actually. And granted, there are a lot of Star Trek video games I never played.
Yeah, I thought it was like the first good example of that. The rest of the game is kind of like, first-person shooter, I'm shooting Romulans, Klingons, Chodak.
What is a Chodak?
A Chodak is another, like, non-canon race. You've never seen them outside, at least as far as I know, you've never seen them outside the Star Trek games. And they have, like, these ships which kind of look similar to what the Orion battleship looks like in Star Trek Online right now. Mm-hmm. But they're, like, bright yellow, and the way they attacked is they have this head, which is, it looks like a hood, but there's no face there or anything like that. Uh-huh. They didn't have a conventional, like, phaser weapon or disruptor or anything like that, but they, like, sonic boomed you or something is what they did. The graphic was literally just, like, some rings coming at you and, like, hitting you, and you just, like, took health damage. It was kind of silly. I was trying to wrap my head around it. And, of course, at this point, the internet was kind of in its infancy at this point as well.
Had Al Gore invented the internet yet?
He did, but, I mean, you couldn't, like, find a lot of, like, you know, like, FAQs or anything like that. So I tried, like, finding, like, Chodak, like, on Star Trek. I couldn't find it anywhere, like, at all. It was kind of unfortunate, because I wanted to know more about these Chodak people who, like, face-pulse me.
What is a Chodak?
What is a Chodak? I don't know. Then there's Birth of the Federation.
Which I really, really wanted to play, but, again, at the time, I did not have a machine capable of running it.
Did you play Master of Orion?
Yes, I did.
Then you played Birth of the Federation.
Really?
Yes.
Oh.
Because it wasn't really all that different from Master of Orion. Because I like Master of Orion because it was space empire building, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost just a clone of Master of Orion. I mean, it was different in the aspects that it was, you know, the major powers at the time, which you had the Dominion, Federation, Cardassians, Ferengi.
Ferengi, huh?
I think Ferengi were playable in it. Romulans, Klingons, I think maybe one other. And Gorn. Then you had... No, Gorn wasn't in there.
Not too bad. Everyone likes Gorn.
Yeah, and then... You could... God, what am I trying to thought? There were all these other kind of smaller, like, species that you found as well, which were, like, you know, the alien of the week from the Next Generation,
mm-hmm.
which were these other allied species you could get. It was, like, kind of like city-states
yeah,
almost city-states in Civ 5.
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of like that. And you could conquer them if you wanted to. And the space battles were very similar to Master of Orion as well, except obviously the graphical UI was updated and they actually interacted kind of more of a 3D plane instead of mm-hmm. a 2D. Ooh, my ship has moved these tiles. Ooh, look at it go. I thought it was a little lacking in that not all the ships that we had saw up to that point were in there.
Really?
Yeah, like, there was a claim that it's like you can make, like, the Oberth class. I didn't see an Oberth in there anywhere.
The game just lied to you? It's like, you can make an Oberth class, but I can't make an Oberth class?
Yeah, it was kind of disappointing. You know, it's because I was really looking forward to, like, having, like, an armada of Excelsior-class starships, because I really like the Excelsior class.
Like, the Excelsior class wasn't in there?
It was not in there.
What?
It was really
sad. That's, like, one of the most iconic ships in Star Trek.
I know,
like,
it wasn't
right
in
behind,
there.
Like, you know, maybe, like, right behind, like, the of the non-Enterprise ships, that's probably the most iconic Starfleet vessel is the Excelsior.
I know.
If only because in Next Generation, the Excelsior was the only other Starfleet ship prop that they had for a while, eventually, they got their hands on the Miranda, and then, it was a bad time to be a Miranda.
The Miranda's in there.
The Miranda is in there.
Yeah, even the variant where the roll bar isn't there with the torpedo launcher.
I love how the Miranda has a roll cage.
I know.
That is so weird.
But the Excelsior wasn't in there. Like, you could get, like, the Galaxy was obviously in there, but there was just all these other starships that just weren't in there, and it really disappointed me. I was just like, not true, Star Trek. But it did have a really, really healthy modding community to it.
Huh, that's cool.
Yeah, so you get these mods which added these starships back in. Which I did. I got the Excelsior as soon as I could. I built a bunch of those and conquered the universe because I thought it was really cool to have Excelsior class. Because it's the best ship ever.
It's your favorite ship ever, anyway.
Best ship.
I'm a fan of the Ambassador class myself, but...
which wasn't destroyed.
It was? Oh, yeah, we found this out. This is something that we'd always wondered about.
News break. Well, for anyone who hasn't heard this yet.
A lot of people have always assumed that the Ambassador model, and if the Ambassador was the Enterprise-C, it was first introduced in yesterday's Enterprise, and then we saw one in the Battle of Wolf 359 in the first episode of DS9.
Yep.
But we never saw it after that. Not even during the Dominion War, when they were having, like, all these huge fleets of ships, we never saw another Ambassador class. And for a long time... people thought, and I'm not sure where this rumor came from, but lots of people thought that the prop had been destroyed.
Yep,
like, the prop had been dropped or broken, and they just decided not to make another one.
This is what I had been read and also had been told by others, was that the prop had been dropped. But I was on YouTube the other day, actually a while ago, not the other day, and watching this, like, auction special, where they're auctioning off all this, like, Star Trek stuff that was used on the shows, props, tricorders, all this kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I see, suddenly... out of a box come an intact Ambassador class model. I'm like, oh, that's cool, Ambassador class. Wait a minute. Ambassador class?
What? Where?
Why? How did you get there?
Where did you come from, sir?
This fully intact Ambassador class model. And I was just, like, flabbergasted.
Did you buy it for me? Because I've always wanted one.
I wasn't in England at the time.
Oh, well.
I think the auction is being held in England.
Also, you probably didn't have, like, $15,000 to spare.
I think it sold for more than that, actually.
Well, that's cool.
Because the Reliant model sold upwards of, like, 25, I think. That was the Reliant model. And then the Enterprise D sold for 72,000.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, there's, like, some pretty ridiculous stuff, prices that are being hiked up there. And then I think I have time for one more, I think, which was Starfleet Command.
I have played this one. Oh, my God. I am so excited. It's a game I finally played.
This is actually the last Star Trek game before we get to 2000 and onwards.
Mm-hmm.
But Starfleet Command was really is really awesome.
It is. It's a really good game.
It just had 4 installments. I don't know if there were any expansions to the first one.
I never actually played after the first one.
Well, there was the first one, obviously, Starfleet Command. And then there was Starfleet Command Volume 2, Empires at War.
My favorite strategy in Starfleet Command was to load up my ship with drones and then just put all shields on front and just charge right at the other ship and fire all my drones when I was like 3 feet away from them.
That's how winners play, it's true.
And you couldn't, like, there was no way to, because by that point, if they actually let you get that close, there was no way for them to dodge all the drones, because the damn, you know, the reason why drones aren't like the greatest thing ever is because you can run away from them, you can shoot them down with point defenses. Mm-hmm. But when you launch that many drones at that close range, it's almost a guaranteed kill.
Yep.
Now, of course, that doesn't work in multiplayer, because in multiplayer they were using, like, electronic warfare that I had no idea how it worked. Like, you would try to play multiplayer and your ship would just stop. And you were like, wait, what is going on? And at first I thought my game was frozen the first time this happened.
Well, that's one of the things I really liked about the Starfleet Command series, all the way up until at least 3 anyway, is that there was a lot of intricacy to it. And I do like games that have a lot of intricacy.
Yeah.
You know, like Europa Universalis, for instance. Oh, man. Ooh. Pretty intricate stuff. I like games like those. So, I mean, Starfleet Command was kind of the first game that I had played, which introduced, like, all these kind of starship combat operation elements, mm-hmm. as well as also taking place on, like, a grand campaign map, where you have your empires in the different corners, and you flip hexes by, you know, doing missions in them to flip them to your side, mm-hmm. is what you did. And, I mean, campaigns would take, you know, like, months yeah. to do. I mean, unless you were, like, really more hardcore than I was, which is, you know, like, a few days, and you were, like, at the homeworld of whoever you wanted to kill, and blew them away. But it was really cool because it was the first time we saw, like, massive fleet-on-fleet engagements take place, mm-hmm. you know, especially, like, in the, what's called the Dynaverse, which was the online multiplayer campaign mode where you still had that map that was online and fight other players, which I have fond memories of Starfleet Command 3 playing with some of those guys on there. But it was just such a really awesome game. But we didn't see any customization mm-hmm. until Starfleet Command 3. Until Starfleet Command 3, all we could do was pick different variations of ships.
Right.
Like, I'm sure you saw, like, there was, like, the Constitution class, but it had, like, a bajillion different variants where there was, like, the Assault one, there was the Command Cruiser, there was, like, the Missile Boat, then there was the Phaser Boat, and there was just all this different stuff, all these variations on that one ship.
Yeah.
Right? I thought it was just really rad, and it just introduced this level of intricate gameplay that I had never seen before, but when it was introduced to me, I fell in love with it instantly.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. And interestingly enough, the Bridge Commander is based off of the Starfleet Command is based off of Starfleet Battles,
which yes.
is a board game.
Yeah.
And it is an incredibly complex board game.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'd have the patience to play the board game.
Yeah, I played the board game.
Because all the math is taken care of for you.
Let me tell you, the board game is fun if you know a lot of people who have memorized the rule book. Because otherwise you have to reference the, like, 4 different pages every time you fire the phasers.
Uh-huh.
And that's a little absurd. But with the math taken care of you through computers, it works out pretty well.
Yeah, that's why the Starfleet Command series, I think, did really well. It's because you had a lot of people who had played Starfleet Battles.
And they
saw,
like,
this, and yeah. they were like, oh man, this is Starfleet Battles, but I don't have to reference the rule book.
This is, like, the answer to all my prayers.
It is the answer to all my prayers, which is really rad. And then there was Starfleet Command 2, or Volume 2, that came out, which was still the motion picture kind of era with the mm-hmm. movies. And they introduced this new species called the Concordium.
The Concordium?
Did you ever play the second one?
No, I only played the first one.
So the Organians apparently disappeared or some such at the end of the first Starfleet Command.
Uh-huh.
And they went off and decided to get some race called the Interstellar Concordium. And their entire mission in life was to bring, like, order to the galaxy.
Dominion says what?
It was sort of like the Dominion. I mean, they looked more like the gray aliens from, you know, like, the movies you see. And
yeah, yeah.
Or, like, Close Encounters of the Fourth Kind, stuff like that. It's this how these creatures looked was what it was. But their whole mission in life was ordained by the Organians, mind you.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, backed by the Organians to stop the warring that was going on between all the factions that was happening, which is, you know, like, Federation, the Gorn Hegemony,
the Klingon Empire,
Romulan Empire.
And there was the Orions?
The Orions weren't in there as an empire. They actually had their own little expansion, which I think we'll have to get to next week because we are running out of time and Rockwell isn't coming up at the top of the hour. But we'll talk about them next week.
We will. We've only scratched the surface of Star Trek.
Yeah, there's so much Star Trek gaming to go through.
I still haven't gotten to tell you about my adventures with the Romulan Warbird.
Well, that's 2002, which right now we just ended 1999 is what we did.
Yeah.
So that's been all things Trek. Kathy?
Do you have
any words for our audience as we part?
Watch Star Trek.
I think we'll have that taken care of. That won't be a problem. All right, folks, I'm going to leave you with a little bit of Danger Zone, because I think Rock was a pretty dangerous guy.
He
so
is.
We're going to prep you with a little
Don't
bit of danger.
Don't cross him.
Don't cry. he's not like an angry drunk sort of dangerous, but he's a shifty character.
All right.
So, you know, have you talked to Rockwell at all?
Very briefly.
All right. So, yeah, he's kind of a shifty guy. You want to watch out for that guy. Has a great show, though. It's coming up right after us at the top of the hour. All right. Well, I've been DJ Bob.
And I've been DJ Oren.
And you've been?
Kathy.
You've been Kathy. All right. We'll see you guys next week.